Welcome to the Cutter's Notch podcast, hosted by author Michael DeCamp and his family. Recorded in the Cutter's Notch studios, this podcast explores anything related to creativity. You'll find interviews with creative people, such as authors, artists, and performers, as well as friendly banter about any number of topics. Turn up the volume, listen, and catch up on what's happening in Cutter's Notch.
Welcome to the Cutter's Notch podcast. I'm your host, Michael DeCamp. And this week, this episode, I am once again all by my lonesome. So as you know, if you listen to this podcast much, I normally co-host with my daughter, primarily my oldest daughter, Angela. Sometimes my my younger daughter, Andrea, fills in, and occasionally my wife, Nancy, steps into the co-host spot. Every once in a while, we've had a full family experience. However, when we first began this podcast, it was originally going to be a solo gig. It was going to be me, and I was going to be interviewing people and talking about various aspects of the writing and authorship experience, and I was going to be talking about my books and such like that. And we really haven't done much of that. Yeah, when I released my nonfiction spiritual enrichment book, Loving Out Loud, we did an episode specifically about that. We did another one when we released my short story collection, Cutter's Notch Interludes. And we did another one just last fall when I released my second novel and the second book in the Cutter's Notch series, Nozomi's Battle. However, we haven't done much as far as me doing a solo run, a solo episode. And I actually prefer to do these episodes with one of the women in my life. But it's not always going to work out that way. There are going to be times when they're all too busy and I need to produce an episode all on my own. This is one of those times. So what I have decided to do as we think about in the future some of the different guests that we're planning to have, I think the next episode after this one's going to be an interesting for you. I won't say much about it, but I'm pretty sure it's going to be kind of a collage of interviews, but we will see. We will see. That might not work out. But this episode will be solo me talking about my Cutter's Notch collection and what my vision is for the Cutter's Notch, for the little town of Cutter's Notch, Indiana. If only it were a real place, right? It's real in my mind. It's real in my heart. And it's real in some of your minds, thanks to the books that you've read that I have produced. So what I'm going to do today is talk a little bit about all of the books in the collection, and I'm going to do some selective readings from each of those books. So hopefully you'll hang in there with me, and we will see where this goes. Now, I am going to stick to our one standard practice, which is to provide you with some insights into our creative moments of the episode. Since the last episode, our family took a really super vacation to Carolina Beach in North Carolina, just south of Wilmington. Had a great time. We rented a condo right on the beach. We were four levels up. So we parked underneath the bottom level or the first level, and then we had to go up the stairs three levels to get to our room. But the view was astounding and the breeze coming off the ocean was sweet. I'm not a super sand person. My wife and daughters love the beach. They love to be on the sand. They love to be in the water. I'm not so much. I went on the beach a few times, but I probably spent more time on the deck just enjoying the view and enjoying the breeze than anything else. But I also during that trip, I read some books. I read a couple of books there, and then I've got a new book that I am in the midst of reading right now. So I'll tell you what the two books are that I read during the trip. They were my guilty pleasure authors. So the first one was by Craig Johnson. It's one of the Walt Longmire series. I'm up to number 9, which is A Serpent's Tooth. That's the title. A Serpent's Tooth. The Walt Longmire series is a pleasure to read. I just enjoy so much the banter between Walt and his under-sheriff of Victoria, and or Vic, as you may know her. If you've watched the TV series, it's kind of a similar attitude among between them, but the Vic in the book is, well, let's say she's got a bigger potty mouth than the one on the television, and she also is a brunette, not a blonde. Enjoy that. I enjoy Standing Bear. The character that was played by Lou Diamond Phillips in the book, he has really long hair and he's bigger. But it's a fun series, and I enjoyed that episode. Following that, I had the book Make Me by Lee Child. It's Jack Reacher number 20. I'm up to the 20th book in the series for Jack Reacher, and another great adventure. This time into the rural Oklahoma area. It's funny where Jack Reacher seems to be able to get in trouble. I used to ask the question of people that if you were in your house and you looked out your window and you saw Jack Reacher walking down your street, would you A, run for your life, or B, feel safer than you've ever felt? Because it seems like wherever Jack Reacher goes, he finds trouble. Ultimately, he prevails, but lots of stuff happens in the meantime. Anyway, Make Me was no different. Another very enjoyable episode of the Jack Reacher series. And currently, I am currently reading a book that I found at Irvington Vinyl and Books, and it's called True Grit. If that sounds familiar, it should, because they've made two movies from this book. There was the original with John Wayne, and then they did the, it wasn't a sequel, it was a remake, maybe 10, 12 years ago? But it was based on the novel by Charles Portis, and so I've been enjoying reading that over the last several days. I picked it up, I guess it was a little over a week ago, but I started reading it while I had surgery last week too, on my knee. And so I started reading it while I was recovering from my surgery. So I'm enjoying that. The interesting thing is that the dialogue and the attitudes come through so incredibly well in the movies compared to the book. And so far it's been very, very true to the book. So I'm getting a kick out of that. It's kind of fun reading that tale. So that's my creative stuff this week. The other thing that I've been stuck on lately is a Netflix series. I started watching Travelers, The Travelers. It's a couple episodes back, maybe it was Sheree Nurse who mentioned that she had binge watched the Travelers series. There's 3 seasons. I'm on season 2 now. So I'm sort of binge watching it, anywhere from 1 to 3 episodes a night. But it's a time travel sci-fi thing. Basically, folks from about 150, 200 years in the future have found a way to come back in time to try to correct the mistakes, correct some things that we did wrong in an attempt to change the timeline and save the world. Because at that point in time, everyone is living underground. And the world's an absolute disaster area. So very interesting series, very interesting story. What happens is the travelers, they don't come back as themselves. They basically take over the life of someone just moments before they die. So they find out from the internet, through the internet, how someone died and when they died, and then they take over their mind right before saving them, and then they go on in that person's persona. So very interesting story, very interesting TV show. So Cutter's Notch. You may wonder how I came up with the name Cutter's Notch. I think I've told the story before, so if this is a repeat for some of you, I apologize. But Cutter's Notch basically came from a couple of things. One, I decided to set the story of my first book, Abandoned Hope, in southwestern Indiana, near the Hoosier National Forest. And I traveled down through that area quite a bit through my regular day job. It took me down through the hills and hollers of that part of our Hoosier state. And I kind of got fond of the area. It was very scenic, very pretty. Throughout that area, there are lots and lots and lots of limestone mines. And in fact, one of those mines I actually got to visit a few years ago. It was probably about 10 years ago. I got to visit Elliott Stone in Bedford, Indiana. And they actually, it's an underground limestone mine. A lot of the limestone mines are pits. So they'll dig, basically they dig the ground up, they find the limestone deposits, and they cut giant slabs of limestone out of the ground, and you end up with a giant pit. But Elliott Stone was actually an underground mine. So we got in the gentleman's pickup truck, and he took us around, drove us into this huge hole in the side of a hillside, and gaping, it looked like a big stone gaping mouth. And we drove back in there, and there's all these lights strung up in the stone ceilings, and you just kind of go back into the darkness, and there were different pieces of equipment, machinery, and basically they were back in there cutting huge slabs of stone from the walls of this underground mine, which was pretty cool. But yeah, I took all of that concept, and then I was also, I visited a theater in Franklin, Indiana called the Art Craft Theater in Franklin, Indiana, which only shows classic movies. This theater doesn't show first run movies. It shows only classic movies. I have seen, Poltergeist there, for example. The movie that I saw that basically impacts this conversation that we're having is the movie Breaking Away. And if you're not sure what that is, Google it. But in the movie Breaking Away, it takes place in Bloomington, Indiana. And there is a group of local boys who enter into IU's annual Little 500 bicycle race, which interesting story in and of itself, but there was a couple of factors in there that come to play when it comes to Cutter's Notch. Number one, there's a scene in the movie where the boys are standing on these giant sheer limestone cliffs, and they dive off into a lake that used to be, basically the lake had filled up one of those limestone mines. And so that imagery found its way into Abandoned Hope. The other thing that I took from that is the college kids at IU in the book, or not in the book, in the movie, they referred to, well, I don't know if it was just the college kids. A lot of the people referred to people who worked in the limestone mines, they referred to them as cutters. And so actually the team, the bicycle team that entered the Little 500 in the movie, they were called the Cutters. And so I took that from that in the sense of created this little town, which was at one time a limestone mining community that was basically flourishing in the mid 1900s during the limestone era. And it takes its name because the limestone miners had cut a notch out of a nearby hillside, basically cutting the limestone out of there. They cut a notch into it. And so the little town became known as Cutter's Notch. And that's where the title for the series comes from, and the name of the little town, Cutter's Notch, Indiana. Now, my vision for this book, this collection, really, is it's going to be a trilogy, and it also has this auxiliary or this extra product, the short stories, a collection of short stories called Cutter's Notch Interludes. So ultimately, the Cutter's Notch grouping will include three novels. I'm working on the third one right now. I'm probably about 85 to 90% through with the story, and then we go into the refining points and basically adding detail, fixing problems, correcting things that don't make sense, and just adding more color to it in that sense, kind of filling in the gaps, stuff like that. So that third novel has not been named yet, but right now there's two novels and the collection of short stories. The first novel, obviously, is Abandon Hope. The second novel is Nozomi's Battle. And the short stories are Cutter's Notch Interludes. Like I said, have not named a third one. Usually the book's title, somewhere along the line, it becomes obvious to me. I'm getting close to the end of this one, and it has not become obvious yet. So I'm waiting for that to happen before I can reveal the title. But so far, when I'm done with the trilogy, there'll be three novels and the short story collections. That might be it, but it might not. The reason I say it might not is because I've created a whole lot of interesting characters. At least I think they're interesting. Plus, I've created a kind of a weird little town where weird things happen, and I like writing stories about weird things. So I'm already starting to contemplate other short stories, maybe even another book that's not directly connected to the trilogy. Some of the characters may show up. Probably a lot of them won't, but it's going to be interesting. So we'll see where I go with this and see what stories emerge from my imagination over the next few years. So let's do a little bit of reading. I thought I would share with you a little bit about Abandon Hope. Abandon Hope is a fantasy. It's a fantasy thriller. So it has real world aspects, but it has fantasy elements. It also has supernatural elements. And so I'm just going to read a little bit out of each one of these books, and we'll start with Abandon Hope. Hope is actually... In the first book, it refers to Hope Spencer. She's one of the primary characters, and she's a 13-year-old girl. So we'll start here. It says, Hope Spencer stepped off her front porch, onto the sidewalk, and into the bright sunshine, carrying the basketball she had won in a tournament the previous winter. Her mother usually nagged her about playing with it. "It's a keepsake," she often said. "You should keep it in your room so it stays nice." Hope thought that was dumb. She would normally reply that a good basketball is simply wasted if all it does is sit on a shelf. And today was no different from those previous days. As she stepped off into the grass that was still wet from the previous night's rain, she bounced the ball one last time on the sidewalk and then tucked it under one arm as she trotted on to join her friends. Stopping halfway to the court, Hope looked around. She felt watched. The deep forest surrounded her neighborhood, and some days it gave her comfort because of the life teeming in its recesses and the birds flitting in and out of the towering limbs. Other days, however, it gave her an uneasy feeling. The shadows under the canopy seemed to hide secrets. Dangerous secrets. Hope grimaced. This was an uneasy feeling kind of day. Hope's friends yelled to her, and she waved back. "I'm just being stupid," she said out loud, but low enough that no one could hear. "A couple of three-pointers and I'll feel better." As she waved at her friends waiting for her on the basketball court, a set of eyes was watching her. The person behind those eyes was shrouded in shadow, well hidden and unnoticed. The person marveled at Hope's strength and beauty, and yet still wanted to slice her throat so that her life would drain out through her slender neck. Soon, thought the owner of the eyes. Very soon. Hope took a shot at the goal before she even reached the court. It rimmed out, but the action had the desired effect. That feeling of lurking danger evaporated from her mind as she released the ball and watched it sail across the pale blue sky. Being active took her mind away from the paranoia that came with the secrets she carried. So she poured herself into sports. Josh flung the ball back to her. "Try again," he said. "I bet you drained it on the second shot." She put it right back up and it zipped through the rim. Nothing but net. The eyes turned away, disgusted and hungry. Time to go hunting. Now I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. Hope opened her eyes. Her head was swimming as her mind swirled back to consciousness. At first, she couldn't figure out what had happened. She definitely did not know where she was. Her head ached, and the hair on the back of her head felt moist. She tried to move and realized she was bound to a chair. Although her eyes were open, she couldn't see anything. The place was as dark as that cave over in the state park she had visited in July. It was as cold as that cave, too. She didn't know how she'd gotten where she was, wherever that may be. The last thing she remembered was walking over the bridge, holding her basketball in her right hand and the milk in her left. She'd heard a vehicle approach, then lights out. She hadn't seen who'd hit her. She hadn't seen her ball bounce over the lip of the bridge, or the milk and her phone getting tossed into the weeds. One moment she'd been strolling along, listening to the birds and feeling the chill of autumn begin to nip at her nose, and the next minute she'd been strapped to a chair in the dark. Could it be him? She tried to focus into the blackness, but there was nothing to see but a sliver of light down low and the hint of a pale rectangle up high to the left. Window? She tried again to move her hands, her feet, her elbows, anything, but she realized that duct tape was wrapped in a myriad of ways around her body. She tried to scream, but the only sound that she made was a muffled hoom. Panic rose. She bellowed into her muffled scream again, over and over. Feeling the blood rushing into her neck and face, she continued her silent screaming until she began to see stars in the darkness. Millions and millions of swirling stars, and then the bliss of unconsciousness returned. I'll stop there. That's the tone of Abandoned Hope. If you like thrillers, I think you'll enjoy it. It's a fantasy thriller. There are some dark undertones, but I had that story playing in my head for a long time. And I had a lot of joy in writing it down. The next thing I'll go to is the short story collection, Cutter's Notch Interludes. The interesting thing about it, there's five stories in Cutter's Notch Interludes. And each of those five stories has some play on the novels. Some of them will give you some background information on locations. Some of them will introduce characters. Some of them will come into play in the third novel. So my suggestion is that you start with Abandoned Hope, then read the short story collection, Cutter's Notch Interludes, before moving on to Nozomi's Battle. I'm going to give you a little sampling of the first short story. It's called Out of the Depths of Abandon. If you were like the crow soaring high above the neighboring treetops, Tim and his 10-year-old son Tony would look like ants skittering back and forth on the grass. They'd fill the wheelbarrow with weeds, sticks, brush, and soil. Then they'd cart it off to the nearby woods to dump the debris. Slowly, being careful to avoid poison ivy, they cleared out the botanical camouflage that kept the great old slab of limestone hidden from view in the middle of their new home's backyard. It was an odd hunk of stone, sitting all alone in that spot for no apparent reason. Flat on top and almost perfectly round, it appeared to have been fashioned into that shape and then moved to its present location for a reason that was lost on everyone. Even the real estate agent who handled their purchase could find no historical reason for it to be there. No remains of an old grist mill, no antiquated mine. Limestone mines had been common in the area, but it seemed that this stone's location had been established long before the mining had even begun. Despite its longevity in that spot, and since it seemed to lack any historical significance, Tim decided the hunk of rock needed to go. A swimming pool was destined to take its place as the focal point of the property. He had visions of something in-ground, a nice patio with lounge chairs and umbrellas surrounding a cool pool of water on a hot, sunny day. It was lunchtime when the man and his son finally cleared out the last load and stood side by side, shovels in hand, gazing at their handiwork. Sweat streaked the accumulated dust on their faces. Tim studied the rock for a long time. Then, that is such an odd place for that stone. "What's so weird about it, Dad?" the boy asked. "Well," Tim scratched his chin, "it looks like it was moved there on purpose. Like someone meant for it to be there. But there's no record of who did it or why it was done. It's almost like it was done prehistorically." He gestured toward the rest of the yard and the nearby forest. "I mean, look. There aren't any other similar stones nearby." "Do you think maybe the Indians moved it there?" Tony asked. "Maybe." Tim trailed off, then said, "It could have been the Adena Hopewell people, I suppose." "Who? You remember when we went up to Mounds State Park in Anderson and saw the Great Mound?" "Yeah," Tony grinned. "We hiked the trails along the river and had a great picnic. The playground was cool, too. They used to live throughout the area. Just as the reasons why they built that mound are long gone, maybe the same people fashioned and put this rock here. For whatever reason. Some of the mounds are burial sites or were ceremonial places, but nobody knows why they built some of the other mounds. They just disappeared. Nobody knows where they went or what happened to them. It's like they had this great community, but then it just vanished. That's weird, Dad." "Yes, it is. Weird is a good word for it." Okay, and jump ahead a little bit in the story. If you want all the details, you got to go get a copy of the book. So here we are. Tim looked at his wife. Genuine fear filled her eyes. As he stood, a thump sounded close, perhaps on the wooden planks that formed the floor of his porch. Now the situation had everyone's attention. Two more thumps. Tim strode directly to the door, threw it open, and stepped out onto the cedar decking. He gasped and stared up at one of the largest men he'd ever seen. Standing just to the right of the doorway and silhouetted by the great old tree was an oddly dressed man with long feather-tipped hair, draped in fur, and carrying a large spear. His bright blue eyes pierced through Tim with an icy stare that could turn even the hottest oceans of courage into ice. Tim froze and took a step back. Recovering quickly, he gathered his wits, tried to stand more upright, and confronted the man. "Hey, what do you want?" he demanded. "Why are you sneaking around my property?" The man stood there quietly. He seemed to be evaluating Tim. His right hand held the spear, but his left hand rested on the hilt of a very large knife. His massive chest rose and fell as he slowly breathed in the evening air. His hand shaking, Tim pressed on. "Speak, man. What do you want? Why are you here? Do I need to call the sheriff?" After a few more moments of silence, the huge figure finally spoke. My name is Tomo. I am the guardian of the stone. He gestured with his spear toward the slab of limestone in the yard. The man's stare didn't weaken. His hand didn't move away from the knife. Nevertheless, Tim was determined to show that he was man enough to deal with this apparent threat. Neither man seemed ready to back down. Okay, Tomo. My name is Tim, and I own this place. I'd like you to get off my porch and leave. You scared my family, and I don't appreciate that. You must not move the sacred stone, the man said in a deep, monotone voice that seemed to boom from his throat with little effort. Do not move the stone. As he spoke, he again lifted his right hand and pointed the spear towards the large limestone slab. My people have guarded that stone for season upon season. It must not be moved. Well, Tomo, apparently your job is done. I own that stone now, and it sits where my pool needs to go. I'll be moving it tomorrow. For the first time, the man's eyes shifted. Interpreting it as hesitation, Tim pressed on. Now, if you aren't off my property in about 30 seconds, I'm going to do two things. I'm going to call 911, and I'm going to get my shotgun. Maybe not in that order. The focus of the ancient figure's eyes reset upon Tim, and he stepped forward into that uncomfortable space directly in front of the smaller man. Since Tomo was several inches taller, he stared down upon Tim's face. The spear again rested on the surface of the porch, but the tip was above Tim's head. I warn you, you must not move the sacred stone. It restrains a great evil that must not be released. Long seasons ago, it claimed many of my people, but the Great Spirit has banished it to the depths of abandon for as long as the stone remains unmoved. Tracy, call the sheriff, Tim yelled to his wife, who was watching the whole thing from the kitchen window. Look, Tomo, if that really is your name, get off my porch and get off my property. I'm going to get my shotgun, and if you aren't gone when I get back, you'll be picking buckshot out of your butt. As Tim moved back toward his door, Tomo stepped off the porch decking. I warn you, you small rooster of a man. Destruction will come to many if you do not heed my words. You must not move the stone. As he said those words, he strode to the far side of the sycamore. All right, if you want to know what happens there, again, you need to get Cutter's Notch Interludes. You can probably guess that Tim moved the stone. So things get interesting. All right, the third reading comes from Nozomi's Battle, the second of the novels. And I got two little sections here to read to you from Nozomi's Battle. The interesting thing about Abandoned Hope it introduces some fantasy characters. And basically, they're elves. So there's a little hint before you pick up the book if you haven't read it already. You're going to meet some characters that are elves. In Nozomi's Battle, we delve a little bit more into the world that the elves come from. And you get to hear a little bit more and some more characters and things about that. So the first reading is going to be in the other world where the elves come from. And the leader of the elves is a guy named Gavin. And so you'll get to hear a little bit about him in this section. So it says, Gavin stepped clear of the trees and into the huge clearing that surrounded the mouth of the great cave. As he stood there glancing around at the place that had been his home for the first 150 years of his life, a strange interaction of weariness and excitement battled for dominance in his mind. He had not been home for many years, but it had been a long journey, and he was bone-tired and quite dirty. Still, he knew he had to present himself upon arrival. It was both customary and a matter of respect to the queen. All visitors to the elf queen's compound were required to make their presence known before doing anything else. But first, I'm going to sit down on this rock and rest my feet. He had followed protocol and reported the entire episode surrounding Hope Spencer's kidnapping and subsequent rescue to the royal office by attaching a scroll to the leg of a fairy, sending the fairy southward. In the human realm, fairies had passed into extinction, but as with many other species, his elfin kin had managed to rescue a representative number into the arboreal realm. In the subsequent centuries, their descendants had multiplied until their population was stable, even slowly growing. Many of them served the queen as messengers. After 2 days, the fairy had returned with the summons. Gavin Allwind of the Trees, proceed to the queen's presence forthwith. Of course, he had left his forest as soon as he received the summons, taking only enough time to change clothes, gather some food, and say goodbye to his brothers, Gronick and Smackle. Now here he was, sitting with his dirty elbows propped upon his dirty knees and his dirty chin cupped inside his dirty hands. Gavin wanted a bath. Pools sat nearby, but he was required to present himself before any activity, dirty or not. He could not tarry long in his rest, lest that be considered a violation of protocol as well. Now I'm going to skip ahead. Some of the characters in first book are Danny and Josh. They're Hope's best friends. They're 12 years old. Danny stirred. He opened his eyes and the world rose like a tunnel above him. He could see the moon. It was a crescent way up above, shining like a dull memory. Around it, his vision swirled. He lifted his right hand to see if he could touch the moon. That's crazy, but I've got to try. As he watched, his fingers stretched out in a long line toward the sky. Maybe I can, he giggled. The sound seemed so silly, so he giggled again. Next to him, he heard someone moan. He flopped his left hand in that direction. The back of his hand landed on a face. Ow, a sleepy voice said. What are you doing? Why did you hit me? Oops, Danny said. Sorry. He looked over. It was too dark to see the owner of the voice, but it sort of sounded like, Josh, is that you? What are you doing in my room? How can I see the moon? Did you cut a hole in our roof? He felt weird. I don't think we're at your house, his friend replied. It's really dark in here. I had a weird dream that I was dragged out of my bedroom window. Me too, Josh said. But I don't think it was a dream. Danny was starting to regain his senses. The world was returning to reality and his ability to think was riding with it. Danny's fingers, which he continued to stare at, began to retract to their normal length. He stared at their silhouette against the light of the moon. I'm cold, Danny said. Me too, Josh answered. Any idea where we are? Not a clue. We're on something hard and dirty. Concrete, maybe. Josh began to feel the area around him. He spread his fingers and reached out to his left. His palm met a hard, smooth, surfaced wall that seemed to have a bit of an arc. Bringing his hand down to the floor, it brushed against something soft. That soft thing squealed and scurried away. The boy sat bolt upright. Danny, I think there's a rat in here with us. Danny quickly sat up also. Josh grabbed his friend's arm and pulled himself next to his buddy. Sliding back against the curved wall, the boys sat huddled together while the moon slowly crossed out of the view above them, and the little light they had faded away. And that is the reading from Nozomi's Battle. So, I hope you found those readings intriguing. All three of those books, Abandoned Hope, Cutter's Notch Interludes, and Nozomi's Battle, are available on Amazon. Actually, pretty reasonable price. You can either get them in paperback or you can get an ebook. If you have Kindle Unlimited, basically you can just download them and start reading them. So what are you waiting for? Give them a try. I think if you like thrillers and you like a little bit of fantasy and maybe a touch of supernatural, I think you'll enjoy these books. Give them a shot. And hopefully you'll be ready for my third one, my third novel, when I get it finished, the fourth book in the overall collection. Thank you so much for joining me in this solo edition of the Cutter's Notch podcast. I want to thank Bill White here for being the producer and helping me to get this thing polished up. Probably when you all listen to this, I will have cut out a number of my gaffes and maybe squeezed down a few gaps in the sound. And after I get done, I send it off to Bill and Bill polishes it even further and then it gets uploaded into the podcast world. So give it a shot. Give it a shot. Thank you so much for joining the Cutter's Notch podcast. And we'll catch you next time when we get another one going here pretty soon. Take care.
The Cutter's Notch podcast is available through most podcast listing providers. New episodes drop approximately twice a month. You can email Michael at authormichaeldecamp@gmail.com. Michael DeCamp is the author of two novels, Abandoned Hope, Cutter's Notch Book 1, and Nozomi's Battle, Cutter's Notch Book 2. A collection of short stories entitled Cutter's Notch Interludes, and one nonfiction Christian devotional book entitled Loving Out Loud, Learning to Love in a Hate-Filled World. All books can be found on Amazon or ordered from your local bookseller. Please join us again on the next episode of the Cutter's Notch podcast.